You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When in 2006 Hu Jintao came to the United States for the first time as president of China, he didn't begin his trip with a visit to the White House. He landed in Everett, Washington, and immediately took a tour of Boeing's production facility there. That's because air travel and infrastructure development has become the centerpiece of China's most recent plan for economic development. It's also the focus of James Fallow's latest book, In China Airborne. Mr. Fallows examines the history of Chinese aviation and how the country's developments in that field serve as a metaphor for its development overall. The book is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased that it has brought James Fallows back to our show today. Hello.
It's very nice to be here. Thanks so much.
You say that China seems to be a country made for travel by air. That's, I'm assuming, because it's so huge.
Yes. Its land mass is about the same as the United States. Its population, obviously, is four times greater, and its physical challenges are greater than those in the continental United States. So what first the Transcontinental Railroad and then the highway system and then jet travel meant to the United States, China is attempting to do in all modes of transport at once.
Well, most of the reports I've read about transportation development in China have focused on high-speed rail. Is the country improving both its rail and air systems simultaneously?
Yes, those two, and also highways, and also low-speed rail, and also ships. And that's one of the things which is so actually always bracing about being involved in modern China. It's doing all of everything all at the same time.
Because high-speed rail and air travel satisfy the same demographic, middle to upper-class people, urban people. So the roads are to take care of everyone else?
Yes, and it's because the relative the demand for transportation is so much more enormous than the existing infrastructure. There are parts of China where high-speed rail is the obvious answer. I came up here this morning on the Acela from D.C. It's much more sensible to take the train for routes like that. But in the western expanses of China, it's so forbidding, it's so mountainous, so distant that it's actually more practical to go by air.
Well, we're also hearing a lot about people who are taking jobs in the along the coast, the Pacific coast, but come from other parts of China, and they on Chinese New Year, they go back, causing all sorts of transportation problems. Is this an attempt to ease some of that craziness?
I think that you can view almost everything about China now is a matter of dealing with whatever is the next constraint. If you see this so-called spring holiday or Chinese New Year travel where you have hundreds of millions of people all trying to go at the same time, it is a phenomenal thing. And so they need more trains for that. They need more cars. They need more roads. And they also need more airplanes. And so air travel, the passenger volume has been going up there about three times as fast as in the U.S.
You lived in China for a number of years. This is your third book that focuses on Asia. What got you interested in China as a subject in the first place?
I think it was I first went there in the mid-1980s when I was living with my wife and our then little children in Japan. We had some oddball excuse to spend a month in China back then, and we saw how different it was from the West, from Japan. And I'd been back and forth, but I'd never really spent serious time there till 6 years ago when my wife and I moved there, lived in Shanghai, then Beijing. And it just is – you can't not be interested in it.
Well, you've also seen the country change incredibly. The first time you went, was Mao still alive?
He was not alive, but his shadow was still there. And I remember in Shanghai, something that stuck in my mind in 86 was the stylish women of Shanghai would have, they'd paint fake nylon lines up the back of their legs. You know, they couldn't afford hose, but that was the way they could seem stylish.
Now, you're a licensed pilot, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
Have you flown in China?
I have. I flew one time. I describe in the book one extremely perilous flight I took as a ferry pilot in China. It's a sign of the relative backwardness of things there that I was one of the more experienced pilots in a certain kind of aircraft there.
This was a Cirrus SR-22?
Cirrus SR-22, yeah. And I was with a friend of mine. We were flying it from Changsha, which is in the center of China in Hunan province, down to Zhuhai for the Zhuhai Air Show. And we had almost everything that can go wrong and have me still be alive here to tell you about it. So I saw a lot of – I saw places that really no other Westerner has seen or written about as they're trying to just have this all-fronts aerospace expansion.
Well, what happened? Was it just a matter of air traffic control being confusing?
There were three things that made this trip one I was glad to have finished. The first one was we couldn't get any gas for this kind of plane. Piston planes, propeller planes run on a different kind of fuel from turbines or jets. And so finally, after trying to get some smuggled across the border from a different province and trying to get some by bribery, it had to be siphoned out of some old Russian trainers members that were there. And this was a little off-putting. We tested to make sure it was still okay. Second, we had a hard time dealing with a Chinese air traffic controller who had never dealt with a foreign private pilot before, and he wasn't letting us climb as we were heading towards some mountains. Finally, a merciful Japan Airlines pilot intervened for us, and the controller was used to dealing with airline pilots. Then on final approach to Zhuhai Airport, which is a very big runway, but it's in the middle of Hong Kong Harbor with peaks all around. We're going down through clouds, and suddenly, for some reason, the instrument landing signal disappeared. And this was a cause of some concern to
us. Was it a problem with the plane?
No. It was something happened on the ground. The guy decided to turn it off. You know, they didn't have that much. Whatever happened, we had a very intense few seconds of negotiation. And at that instant, we were about to zoom up into Hong Kong airspace. I saw the runway through the bottom of the cloud.
Will that change now? Because Cirrus, as I understand it, the company that designed and manufactured the plane, eventually was bought out by a Chinese company.
Yes. About a year and a half ago, the Chinese aerospace monopoly bought what had been and still is the most innovative small plane company in the world, a sort of modern Wright Brothers story of success from Duluth, Minnesota. So we now have Zhuhai near Hong Kong owning this firm in Duluth. So that they're trying very quickly to improve their infrastructure.
Well, around the time of the buyout, the American employees were concerned that their jobs would be outsourced to different countries. Did that happen, or are they still producing the plane in Duluth?
They're still producing it in Duluth, and there's a sort of droll comment that the Chinese purchaser said, which is that if they built these things in China, then their customers wouldn't buy them, including the ones in China, because this is an industry where you really have to have a long record of actually making things in a safe way. You get on a Boeing airplane or an Airbus, you know people have been getting on and off of those for a very long time. The Chinese are trying to build their own new airliner, and it'll take a while before that has the same kind of safety record.
Well, they've relied on Russian-made planes before that, Soviet-made planes, and they don't have as good a safety record.
That's true.
And we just heard about another problem with Aeroflot.
That was a terrible problem for the Russian aspirations in aerospace. One reason that Hu Jintao, as you said, made his first stop in Seattle in 2006 is that, in a way, Boeing has been a third government in all dealings between the U.S. and China. It's had a huge sort of negotiating influence. The main growth area in its sales is in China. And also the Chinese are trying to create their own future Boeing. So the contest here is a very interesting one.
But their top airlines rank first, third, and fourth in valuation globally, while the U.S.'s top airlines are only 9th, 10th, and 11th. What's that based on?
That's a sign partly of concentration on the Chinese side, partly of the screwiness of the Chinese stock market. You're never really sure what things are worth, but also the fact that the real center of growth in air travel in the last 10 years since 9/11 has been mainly in China. To a lesser degree, the Gulf and India, but China has been the place.
My guest is James Fallows, a national correspondent at The Atlantic, also a contributor to Slate, the New York Review of Books, The New Yorker, and NPR. His latest book, China Airborne, which tells the story of what's happening in China these days as China modernizes. And China always seems to modernize through five-year plans. It's had 12 five-year plans. So that's 60 years of five-year plans in a history that's not 64 years or something like that.
So it's 60-plus years. So we're in the middle of the 12th one now. And this whole concept sounds preposterous to us, a five-year plan.
Based on the Soviet model.
Exactly.
But does that mean anything? I would assume the more recent five-year plans have been attempts to correct the five-year plans during the Maoist period.
They have been, and this one is particularly significant because it's the attempt to change China from the success of the past 30 years, low-wage manufacturing, construction, infrastructure, and all this, to a genuinely rich country, having pharmaceutical industries, telecom industries, infotech, and aerospace, and clean energy, too. So it's the effort to sort of make the whole economy pivot from this Dickensian working-class economy to a more modern U.S.-like, German like Japanese one. That's the process they're in the middle of.
So they want to go from low tech to high tech.
Yes.
But are they going to abandon low tech?
I think they would like to rise above it. And if we are having this conversation in Beijing right now, a lot of the concern among the Chinese economists would be whether they'd gotten into what they call a low wage trap, whether they're just going to become a bigger and bigger version of a sort of lower middle class country. That's really a story I'm trying to tell in this book of whether they're going to be able to make that change.
Well, when Japan faced that crisis, they just simply started shipping out the low-wage jobs to other countries and helped the South Korean economy to grow, the Taiwanese economy to grow, more recently, I guess, Vietnam. So is there any place China can go?
It's there is potential for China. It's worth recognizing how different their situation is from Japan's, because Japan a century ago was already a modern, relatively rich country. And after World War II, they had all the framework of these big international corporations like Mitsubishi and the rest. China doesn't really have any big international corporations. It has some former state monopolies like Sinopec and the aviation ministry. It has these little tiny 50-person, very fiercely competitive manufacturing shops and a few huge factories also, mainly foreign-owned, but it doesn't have a GE, a Siemens, a Google, an Apple, and that's what they're trying to develop.
So the people who manufacture Apple products, are those companies are foreign-owned? Those huge things, I've seen
yes.
documentaries where the camera just moves for 10 minutes down one wall.
The famous Foxconn is actually a Taiwanese-owned. And I've been to all the supply places. If you have an iPhone or an iPad, I've seen its birthplace. And it's partly it's these gigantic workshops with thousands and thousands of people, but it's partly little tiny machine shops where people are competing for fractions of a cent price advantage.
As of 2010, China had roughly 2,600 commercial airplanes. That's about half as many as the United States, although its population is four times
right.
as large. So does that mean that people don't fly as much in China?
It means they're not flying as much as they would like to. And so every single year there's been a double-digit increase in traffic. And really the constraint is simply a physical one, having enough airplanes and enough airports. So they're buying airplanes like crazy. Airline travel in China is actually very pleasant because the planes are all new. They always give you a hot meal. And how do I put this delicately? They're allowed to hire flight crews on the basis of youth and appearance. So it's different from the Western model.
Well, you were talking about how there are a lot of tinkerers in China. Well, isn't the tinkering what got our airplane industry going? The
yes,
Wright brothers.
Exactly. And so 100 years ago, the U.S. had this very diverse ecology of tinkerers, and the military was the first customer for the Wright brothers, and the post office, when it brought in airmail, that was a huge source of revenue, and the early airlines and the Barnstormers and all the rest. China, for the last 100 years, has had a military-only aviation model. And one thing I loved was going around the country and seeing all these tinkerers and dreamers who said, hey, I'm going to build my own helicopter, or hey, I'm going to build my own small seaplane. I'm going to have a new industry. So you find the same kind of Wright Brothers era explosion of little innovation around China.
It's my sense that the Chinese government wants to be in control of everything.
Yes, and this is the central drama in China right now, or maybe one of them, the other being the environment. So the central drama is the people who want to have China have a brighter business future, it mainly means relaxation of government controls. The government has done a lot of that, although, as we know, it hasn't relaxed all of its controls. In airspace,
and then it seems to be inconsistent.
Yes, it goes back and forth, and I think for the last year or two, we've been in a tightening control period generally in China, not in the south so much, but in certain high-profile ways, it's been tightening. Airspace is right now one of the most controlled parts of Chinese life. So the people who want to use business jets, build helicopters, start new airports, their main foe right now is the People's Liberation Army Air Force, which controls all the air.
Well, if you want to build an airport in a country that's so densely populated, doesn't that mean forcing people out of their homes and their farms?
It does, but what's the problem? I mean, I'm sounding crass, but that is something that China has done a lot of over the last 30 years, of just making people go away. And also, a lot of the country doesn't have anybody there. And so they place with a relative shortage of airports is mainly the West, which is quite vast.
So, but if you build airports there, maybe you'll attract people to the West, although most of the industry is along the Pacific coast.
Well, it's exactly that problem that is making this so-called Go West campaign in China, because the western half of China is essentially like the Rocky Mountain or Great Basin. It's like America without California or without a Pacific coast. It's very difficult territory and very poor.
So but it does have India and some other growing countries on
its
borders.
It does, but on the other side of the Himalayas. So you have, you know, the great Tibetan plateau. You have Xinjiang in the northwest, which is a gigantic, mainly desert area. And to reach those areas, railroads are difficult, roads are difficult, and air is the main way they're trying.
James Fallow's latest book is called China Airborne. It's published by Pantheon. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's also contributed to Slate, the New York Review of Books, The New Yorker. And you probably recognize his voice from all of his various visits to NPR shows since 2009. He's been a regular news analyst for Weekend All Things Considered. His latest book is called China Airborne. It is published by Pantheon. I was surprised that China's first brush with international aviation came when Henry Kissinger made that secret visit to the country in 1971.
There was a real panic by the Beijing airport officials before his arrival. Of course, this was a secret in the world's eyes. He came from Pakistan on a Pakistan International Airlines plane, and it was a Boeing 707, you know, now out of service, but at the time, the dominant plane everywhere in the world except China. They only had their own Soviet planes that went there. And so the concern was, how were they going to get him off the plane? It was a different height from the Soviet plane. So there was this panicked effort by the Beijing officials to kind of reverse engineer some stairs, and it worked.
And what happened later when Nixon came as a result of those negotiations? Well, that was on a U.S. plane.
Yes, it was on Air Force One, which was also a 707 in those days. And so they had the ramp they built for Henry Kissinger. They were all set. And then one of the main things that Zhou Enlai agreed during Nixon's early visits was that a big Boeing purchase would be one of the center points of the U.S., the new U.S.-China relation, partly because they wanted to the Chinese thought this was a very important sort of political gesture, partly it was to escape these Soviet planes.
But it's also a military matter, isn't it? Because the military pretty much controlled everything aviation in China?
Yes, that is the heritage that even right now the Chinese high-tech officials are trying to evolve away from. That's from the earliest communist era. Mao viewed aviation as a purely military proposition. For example, the main military works was in Xi'an, the place we're all familiar with from the Terracotta Warriors. But Mao's reasoning was it was so far away from the borders and it couldn't be bombed. And so that's where a lot of the military work went on.
Is it true that until recently Chinese citizens needed permission from the government to buy a plane ticket?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been now a decade or more since the time of the liberalization, but it's a symbol of how sort of freedom of movement, which we take for granted, has been an area of residual control. For example, it still is very hard to buy accurate maps in China. And if you look on Google Earth at a view of Beijing, you'll see on the west side of Beijing this gigantic airport. It's like JFK, that's not on any maps of the city. And it's not, if you're driving by there on the Fourth Ring Road, there's no exit sign for it. And it's a sign of kind of the control in the sense of concern about whether we don't want foreigners knowing where things are.
Well, if China wants to dominate its own air industry, it's going to have to build things, which means that it's going to have to know how to build things. And there are certain secrets that Boeing and the companies that build the Airbus and all of the other major manufacturers keep. Are they willing to share it with China?
Obviously, Boeing and Airbus, and then at the component level, GE and Pratt & Whitney, which make the engines, and Honeywell, which make the avionics, they want to keep their lead. And I think there are two secrets, and then one sort of larger cast of mind that are obstacles for the Chinese efforts. One of the secrets is engine technology, which is really the main thing in making airplanes advanced or not. GE, Pratt & Whitney, and Rolls-Royce are the world's leaders there. They want to keep their lead even as they have to do some work in China. A second, perhaps surprising secret is just complex integration, being able to have millions of parts come together. When Boeing has had some problems with its new Dreamliner, part of the reason was they outsourced too much of the engineering and design. And so integration is a challenge. Then even more, there's sort of the having a advanced liberal technological society that is uncontrolled in various ways.
On the other hand, in this country, airplanes, at least the ones that have any kind of government involvement, have their parts made in every congressional district possible because that's part of the deal. In China, I'd imagine you don't have to worry about that.
There's a different version of the same kind of pork barrel politics that works in China. Indeed, I would say that local pork barrel politics is even more important there because behind almost everything that's happening in China now is some big real estate deal. And you have each mayor, each provincial governor, each party boss has some scheme for a new factory in his province. They're all building. The reason there are more than 100 airports being built in China now is that every little guy has some gleam in his eye about what it will mean to have some potential aero hub in his province.
And where does he get the money?
There is just a huge pot of mainly government money for infrastructure and construction. It's been, if we think of our stimulus program the last couple of years, you take that up an order of magnitude, and you have the Chinese miracle of recent years.
There have been a lot of crashes in China over the years. So there were, especially when they were relying on Soviet airplanes.
Yes, there were until about 15 years ago. And one of the stories I tell is of the entirely unpublicized effort, mainly by a bunch of Americans working for Boeing and the FAA and some for United Airlines, who essentially made themselves part of the Chinese infrastructure and said, if you want to run a safe air travel system, here is how you do it.
E.E. Bauer and a man named, with a very difficult last name, Joe Timchichin.
Yes.
Well, Chichin.
Very good. I never dare actually say it. I call him Joe T, as most people in China do. He's a Boeing employee originally who's essentially become a Chinese person, more or less like there's a wonderful book, The Memory Palace of Matteo Ricci, about the old Jesuit who went to China, you know, centuries ago and sort of made himself part of the system. A lot of Westerners, especially Americans, have done that. People like this Joe T, whose mission is to say, here's how you test pilots. Here's how you have navigation systems. Here's how you license planes. And there have been very few crashes in China in the last decade.
A listener posted a comment on our show page asking about the unique aircraft, Y-U-N-E-E-Q, the first all-electric battery-powered trainer. Does that have a place in China?
Yes, it does. And it's part of a – this is a man who I've tried to meet several times, the inventor of it, and I'm going to Shanghai 36 hours from now, and I'm hoping to be able to have a chance to see him again. His all-electric plane is unique, so to speak, on the Chinese spectrum, but it is typical in that you have lots of people saying, this is our Wright Brothers moment. So people making homemade helicopters, homemade man-craft flapping wing things, small craft. So it is as fertile in that way as you would expect.
Now, we were talking about the five-year plans. China's focus on infrastructure is the latest step in a plan for economic development that first centered on agriculture, then moved to factories and manufacturing. Those practices all produced exportable goods. What about this focus now on infrastructure and aviation? Can any money be made out of that?
Yes, and I think the two-pronged strategy from the Chinese point of view is, first, they have their own gigantic domestic market, which can be satisfied, even though it may take a long time before anyone in the Western world buys Chinese airliners, for example. Their own airlines and regional ones are potential markets, and they hope to get into higher value exports too later on.
The whole matter of whether to spend money on stimulus is controversial in this country. Yesterday, Premier Wen Jiabao called for Chinese economic stimulus, mostly in the housing market. Has the government given attention to these sorts of projects, or has most of their money gone to fund travel infrastructure?
Well, it's funding all of everything. We were living in Beijing during the big slowdown in late 2008 and into early 2009, and you could just see people being laid off day by day by day. These migrant workers were taking buses back to the countryside. But then when you went out to the countryside, you saw every road had 100 people per mile doing paving on it. And so there's no pussyfooting about stimulus projects in China.
But what about the quality of all of these things, the new airports, the roads, and the buildings? Almost 70,000 people were killed in an earthquake in China in 2008, and many of those deaths were obviously the result of shoddy construction.
Yes, indeed. So I think like everything in China, it is highly variable. There's some things which are at the very high end and make you feel bad for American infrastructure. There's a lot that's slipshod, corrupt, going to fall apart. Another aspect of that horrible Sichuan earthquake is that more than half the people died after the initial shock. They died of exposure in the next couple of days because there was no way to reach them. The roads were destroyed. There were no helicopters and things like that. So I think there is a a push in China to do more things and to do them a lot better.
Well, you point out that the newly built CCTV tower appears to be aging rather quickly.
The air pollution in most big Chinese cities is so, so bad. I felt like I was aging a year per day I was there. And this building, which has barely opened for business, looks like it was 20 years old, even though it was built at the time of the Olympics.
There was a time before the Olympics when people talked about how you could see the air in Beijing. Can you still see the air there?
Yes. There was a time when it looked as if it was getting better for the year or so after the Olympics, but that seemed to be an artifact of the slowdown. Now the cars are increasing so much that even though a lot of the big factories are out of Beijing, the air pollution there most of the time would be considered simply incredible by U.S. standards.
But the Chinese supposedly are doing things to improve that. They're going
green.
Is it being effective?
It is being more effective than if they didn't do it. I think that in most things environmental in China, it's a contest between how bad it is and how hard they're trying to cope with it.
So are they doing things like solar panels and windmills?
Yes. So one of the big controversy in the solar panel industry in the U.S. now is sort of this mass Chinese, often a subsidized production of solar panels that has changed the price structure. So there is a huge clean energy boom in China. There's also a coal boom. There's also a nuclear boom. There's also a hydro boom because demand is going up so fast.
We just heard a report this morning about, I think it may have been in Mongolia, but the growth of copper and gold mining and how much water it requires, especially in areas where generally desert areas where the aquifer is limited.
I think if you were to – I've interviewed scientists who say that really the worst environmental challenge for China is the water problem because the northern half of the country is essentially arid. The water table in Beijing has gone down hundreds of feet, and so this is really not sustainable and may be the first thing that stops them.
The current government agency that oversees aviation in China is called the Commercial Aircraft Group of China, or COMAC. What specifically are they in charge of?
They are the ones trying to build a big plane like a Boeing or Airbus plane. There's a bunch of sort of subsidiaries within the mothership that's called AVIC, which is the Aviation Corporation of China. Interestingly, a generation ago, there was one organization in China built the airplanes, ran the airlines, trained the pilots, trained the flight attendants, so that they've broken that up somewhat.
Well, during the Meiji period, the Japanese simply bought Western goods, took them apart, and then duplicated them and wound up building ships that won a war almost immediately. Can't the Chinese do the same thing, just take apart one of those Boeing airliners?
Certainly that's happened in lots of less complex products than airplanes. And Siemens, for example, is regretting a lot of its high-speed rail projects in China where there has been a lot of reverse engineering. So far,
well, did they pay patents?
They paid they paid for the first couple of trains and not the next few hundred. They were able to do themselves. So far, large airplanes seem to be more complex than is really subject to that kind of reverse engineering. And again, Japan, the miracle of Japan is in the 30 years after the Meiji Restoration, it modernized so thoroughly, so quickly. China has de-peasantized itself to some degree, but not modernized in the same way.
While all of this is going on, we are seeing what seems to be a war within the government over whether to allow any kind of dissidents. This latest thing with the blind activist who seemed to be doing good, obviously. He was acting as a lawyer for people who were being mistreated. You would think the government would encourage that sort of thing. Instead, they arrested him. And you say that you got a clear picture of the Chinese government's interventionist policies because of a crackdown on protests on May – what was it?
They call it May 35th.
I was afraid to say May 35th because I know that's not really a date.
Yes, and that's the sort of term of art among some Chinese bloggers for June 4th, which is which was the anniversary of Tianemen Square crackdowns 20 years ago.
Oh, they can't say June 4th ever.
So they say May 35th. It's one of many terms of art. And my wife and I were there last year during the crackdown on the so-called Jasmine Revolution after the Arab Spring uprising. And there is a real tension in China on this question. You know, with the blind dissident, Mr. Chun, it's significant. The central government never arrested him or imprisoned him. It was sort of local officials, in a way like the Mississippi situation 50 years ago or so. But the central government, on the other hand, didn't protect him. And it's a sign of just one of many fissures and things now being worked out.
Well, there's the mayor who suddenly has been disgraced,
yes,
which has brought down large portions of the government in Beijing as well.
And it's worth remembering this next year is a very, very sensitive one for the government because it's the big transition of power, which happens in effect every 10 years to a new governing slate, a new president, probably a new premier, and new 7 of the 9 members of the governing council. And this Mr. Bo Xilai, who's now been his wife's being arrested for murder, and he's out of action, he was expected to be one of the ruling 7. So the whole murkiness and transparency and suddenness of it is a problem.
And the people who supported him are in precarious positions. Many have already lost their jobs. The ones who have remained in power become subjects of interest because how did they remain there when others have lost their jobs?
Yes, and the kind of wealth that Mr. Bo and his family were accumulating, it's not unique to him. There was a great story in the New York Times a couple of days ago. The children, the sons in particular, of all the ruling leaders are big venture capitalists and things like that.
It sounds like what we used to do with the Soviet Union with the Kremlinologists, where something would happen, somebody would suddenly not appear in a photograph, and everybody would start reading the tea leaves to figure out what was really going on.
There was a case about a month before things really hit the fan with Bo Xilai. There was a big party meeting in Beijing, and people did notice that Bo Xilai was way off on one side of the podium and looked sort of upset. So that old Cold War skill of Kremlinology, even now, because the government is not transparent, is still applied both inside and outside China.
A few weeks ago, the BBC reported that China's economic expansion slowed for the first time in 3 years. Is that a sign that expansion is slowing overall?
It is a sign in the short term that we're going to see a lot more stimulus. I think there's going to be more. Another construction infusion is going to be sent. In the longer term, it's one of many, many signals of the change the Chinese government is trying to will itself towards, of being on a different path from these last 30 years, of wanting to become more of an actual rich country. And whether that is possible with their current political system is the dynamic that's being played out.
I've wondered about those 5-year plans because that locks you into something maybe 3 years down the line you don't think it's so good anymore.
That's true, but you can do – if you think of them – on balance, I would say they do more good for China recently than harm because they can say we're going to have 5 years of investment in clean energy, 5 years of investment in pharma, 5 years in aviation. And along the way, there's so much of China that's seething and innovating and adapting that's not too controlled.
Well, most of the books we've seen about China talk about trends, and they always have a chapter near the end about what lies ahead. You haven't done that much here. Is it impossible to see into the future of China?
It is impossible. It is possible to guess. I argue that it's intellectually defensible, i.e., and even more respectable and proper to recognize the fundamental unknowability of what's going on there. No sane person can tell you what the weather is going to be like a year from today. And I think something is similar with China 5 years from now. The forces are so contradictory and so unpredictable that it's worth just being alert to them.
Well, one of the things that confused me is that many of the flights within China take place at only 10,000 feet, which is significantly less efficient both in terms of time and fuel than the standards that other countries use. Why do they fly so low?
Here's the only good environmental reason news about the Chinese aerospace boom is that it could be much more efficient if simply the military didn't make the airliners do these really inefficient things, indirect routes like going from New York to D.C. via Chicago or something because of the military quarters and flying at these grossly inefficient low altitudes. Most U.S. airliners, Western airliners, fly somewhere in the 30,000 feet. That's where it's most efficient. The air is thin. There's no drag. At 10,000 feet, it's like swimming with a big sea anchor or on the freeway in first gear. But the military, it can control where they are that way.
So they want the higher altitudes for themselves?
Yes. And they have no interest in the efficiency of this private industrial activity.
Well, how much military air travel traffic is there right now?
There's not that much, but they have all the airspace. So it's just it's theirs. They don't want to give it up. They don't like the idea of this uncontrolled movement. So that's the frontier that's being contested.
Well, if we can predict the future, you mentioned earlier the low-wage trap. China's trying to get out of that. But in some ways, doesn't it shoot itself in the foot?
It does. And the prediction I will boldly make is that if China is able to evolve to the kind of society that can compete with Boeing, that can compete with GE or compete with Google, that actually will be good news for us because it will be a better kind of China to deal with, one that is less entirely bound up and controlled with a less sort of defensive government. So a China that would compete with us is one easier to live with, too.
Although we've heard for many years that as China grows, it's going to become more democratic. That doesn't seem to have happened.
Yes, that was clearly untrue. The question is whether they can take the next step without becoming more liberal in various ways.
James Fallows will be in conversation with Orville Schell tonight at 6:30 at the Asia Society. That's at 725 Park Avenue at 70th Street. For more information, visit our show page at WNYC.org. His book, China Airborne, is published by Pantheon.